Alright, hello, welcome to episode 8 of Hits and Gigs. My name is Noah Sherman. Joining me, as always, is Savik Panelik.
Good to be here, Noah.
Dan Rougeau is not here this time because we're doing a bit of an abbreviated episode, and Dan is quite busy. But we spoke to Josh Grossman. We just did a quick little interview, and instead of waiting a few days, we felt like it might be a better idea just to put it up right away, because we talked about a lot of things related to the Jazz Festival. And if we were to wait, the Jazz Festival would be a few days in. You might miss some of the stuff he talked about. So, Savik, what do you think? Should we just go for it?
Yeah, let's just put this thing up and get people going out to these shows.
Cool. All right, so here is our interview with Josh Grossman, Artistic Director of Toronto Downtown Jazz, which is the organization that oversees the Jazz Festival. We are pleased to be joined right now by Josh Grossman, the Artistic Director of Downtown Jazz, which is the organization that oversees the Jazz Festival. How you doing, Josh?
Fine, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, we're happy to have you. So I guess I'll just start by asking you, how did you come to be the Artistic Director of Downtown Jazz?
the short answer is I applied for the job. The longer answer is... I guess when I was in school, I did the jazz performance program at the University of Toronto with a specialty in trumpet. And when I was in school, I thought for sure I was going to do music professionally and performance career. And I got out of school and things started in that way. And I was getting some gigs and doing lots of private teaching and working part-time a little bit on the side. But eventually I realized that the requirements of a performance career in my discipline did not necessarily match up. And so my interest sort of started to get a bit broader within the music world, and I had an interest in music administration that had been forming. So I started off doing a couple of music admin jobs. I worked at the Royal Conservatory of Music for 4 years. I managed a children's choir for a couple of years. I am still working with a contemporary music ensemble as an administrator. I started my own big band, which I still have 15 years later. And I was the artistic director for the Markham Jazz Festival for 4 years. So all of this different experience between the performing side, the administrative side, within the jazz world and in other worlds, kind of all combined together. And when the Jazz Festival opportunity came up, I wasn't really thinking about applying until a couple of different people who I had a lot of respect for suggested that I apply. So I applied, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Wow. Yeah, so that's quite an extensive background in like the administrative side of things. Was it... Is something that you just kind of jumped into while you said you were teaching and playing a bit, or had it always been something that you wanted to do?
I think it had always sort of been an interest of mine. Even before I got to university, I was very involved in the music council at my high school at Lawrence Park Collegiate. When I got to university, I was involved in the Faculty of Music Undergraduate Associate there. I played in a wind ensemble called the Toronto Youth Wind Orchestra, and I served on the board of directors for that. So there, I was just sort of interested in how things worked behind the scenes and seemed to have a bit of an aptitude for it. So kind of pursued those opportunities simultaneously with performance opportunities. And when it became clear that one was going to be more obvious for me than the other in terms of actually making a career of things, then I started really pouring my energy into it.
So Josh, just getting into stuff festival related, I was curious as to what you look for when you're viewing applications for the Jazz Festival.
It's a good question. Primarily, and again, there's sort of the short answer and the long answer. The short answer is the music good and interesting? And that's sort of where things start for me. But from there, it gets kind of complicated because whether the music is good and interesting to me doesn't necessarily have a bearing on whether other people think it would be good and interesting. And ultimately, we're trying to find acts that we find really are good, that we think are interesting, but that also our audience are going to enjoy and think are interesting. So that's a bit complicated sometimes to find the balancing act between those two things. And then In addition to that, there is a complicating factor, which is a lot of our shows are ticketed. And so not only does the music have to be good and interesting, but it actually has to sell tickets. So what ends up happening is there are a number of acts which meet those criteria perfectly, and it's always really exciting to find those acts and get them on our stages. But then there are a lot of acts that, for one reason or another, can't quite meet all those criteria and don't end up getting booked. And that, in some ways, as the artistic director, is one of the most frustrating things for me, is because there's so many good musicians out there and so much great music. But within the parameters that the festival works, it's hard to book at all.
Yeah, I definitely get that.
Yeah. Is it, like, how often would you say you get an application and the music is amazing, but you just can't put them in because they just won't sell? Like, is that...
Yeah, I mean, it happens often enough. And there are a number of reasons that groups won't sell. I mean, sometimes the music is very, very niche, for example, and just doesn't have enough interest to sort of sell enough tickets. And unfortunately, we're currently not set up to really support that kind of music. And that's what I hope is one of the things that will change about the festival, is that we find ways to support some of this music that I think is really great and is really important to jazz in general, but isn't just going to sell the tickets. So that's one thing that happens. But the other thing that happens is oftentimes I'll get submissions from different parts of North America or even different parts of the world, which really sound great, but the artists just aren't known here. And the feasibility of bringing an artist to Toronto when they're from out of town, if they're really not known, unfortunately works against the whole process.
Right.
And again, I wish that wasn't so, but just practically, if you think about it, I mean, to get an artist to Toronto from almost anywhere, you're talking about, you know, $500 to $1,000 each in travel, plus you got to put them in a hotel, plus you got to find a venue, and then you got to actually pay them a fee for performing. So the numbers add up very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Actually, that sort of answers a viewer question that we had. Someone was wondering how come there were so few sort of avant-garde and free shows at this year's festival, but I guess that your answer right there basically answers that question. They're not going to be able to sell enough tickets.
Yeah, and that's, in some ways, if I'm going to be perfectly honest, that's kind of a lame answer to that particular question, because in my view, I would like the festival to be a place where we're presenting a wide variety of music and people can come and experience a whole variety of music. But ultimately, there is a bottom line to be met, and it depends from year to year how much flexibility we have in that bottom line. It just so happens that this particular year, we didn't have a lot of flexibility, and so what we've ended up with are some pretty great shows, but shows that are perhaps a little more straight down the middle than in past years.
Yeah.
Right. I have a question about how the festival kind of deals with venues.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's obviously like a... Like, it seems like it's a very good relationship between the festival and venues. Do you guys, like, add new venues periodically? Or, like, how's the relationship in terms of that? Like, does a venue come to you, or do you go to a venue to say, hey, we want to make you a part of the festival?
Sure. I guess there are a couple of different relationships that exist. I mean, first of all, we build the 1,200-seat tent at Nathan Phillips Square, and so we pay for that. We control that whole thing. We keep all the revenues from ticket sales and refreshments and all that sort of stuff. And then there's kind of the straight rental deals. For example, if we go into Massey Hall or Kerner Hall, they have a rental, they charge us the rental. We pay for the artist, and we keep the ticket sales. But otherwise, you know, they get their rental fee, they keep all the refreshment sales, etc. And then there's a relationship that, like, we have, for example, this year with the Horseshoe Tavern or the Jazz Bistro. And that's a great relationship, because what we do is we go to these places, we say, look, we want to bring an artist into your club. How can we work together? And the clubs say, this is really exciting. You're going to bring all these people to our club. So tell you what, why don't we not really charge you a venue rental fee? You come in here, put on a great show. We'll keep the bar sales. But the festival takes care of all the artist tab, all the backline tab, and everything like that. So that's a really good relationship for all involved, because the bar is maybe getting people in that wouldn't necessarily come in. We're getting a venue of the appropriate size for an artist to work with. And I guess the last relationship is with kind of the larger circle of clubs that you'll see listed on our brochure and on our website. And essentially, we're providing free marketing for them. They do all of their own booking. They pay all their own artist fees. But we're happy to list them under the auspices of the festival on our website and on our brochure. And again, that's mutually beneficial. We get to show the breadth and depth of jazz that's happening during the festival, and they get to sort of have a little bit of a marketing bump in their efforts. So we are on the lookout for venues that sort of prop up on the scene and seem to be happening, seem to be presenting a lot of music over the course of the year. And occasionally we'll reach out to venues, but often enough, venues will reach out to us.
Nice. Cool.
It's really great to hear, actually, that the festival and so many venues have such a fantastic relationship. That's really nice to hear from a musician's perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. And what it means is that there is some flexibility in the acts that we bring in. So if we do have an act that we feel is only going to sell 150 or 200 tickets for whatever reason, we can typically find the right size venue for that artist.
Do you find, are there ever issues with bringing artists in to venues? Because you said one of the relationships was that, like, you'll try and host the artist at a venue. Are there any issues ever where, like, maybe you'll get way more people than you expected? Or, you know, like, the artist is unhappy for whatever reason?
Sure, that comes up on occasion. I can't think of too many times where we've been really oversold. Certainly there have been shows that have sold out and we've had more demand for tickets. But, you know, we're pretty strict with that. We don't oversell venues. We pay attention to their fire code and things like that.
Right.
And absolutely it happens on occasion where an artist is not happy with the venue for one reason or another, and it's really rare that we have to switch venues. We do our best in advance to think everything through, make sure that the type of artist and the type of music being performed suits the venue well, the type of back line that's being requested is going to actually work in the venue. You know, the Horseshoe Tavern, for example, doesn't have an acoustic piano, but when Jason Moran says, "I need a grand piano," we say, "You know what, you're Jason Moran, I think we can make that work." So... you know, and again, Jason Moran is a musician who, depending on the type of music he's playing, might play in a really beautiful concert hall or might play in a bar or something in between or in the tent. And for this particular show that he's doing, this Fats Waller dance party with Michelle and Degideo Cello, the Horseshoe is going to be a perfect setting for it. It's the right size. It's the right vibe. So, yeah, we really try to match things up that way.
Perfect.
Great. Josh, I was going through the website and I was just curious as to what initiatives the festival's taken to engage a wider audience in jazz and just live music as a whole?
Yeah, that's good. Good question. And we're sort of constantly working at this and trying to figure out how to bring more people in. So if I take a look at this year, for example, one of the things that we're trying to do is we're really trying to create a destination at Nathan Phillips Square. So in the past, we've always had, you know, various things happening during the day, but we've had trouble maintaining activity over the course of the day. And so people would come, for example, for a 12:30 show and then disappear again and maybe show up again for the evening show. So this year we've got a free concert at 12:30 featuring a different big band every day. And then that sort of wraps up around 2. From 3 to 6, we have strolling bands on Nathan Phillips Square, a different sort of marching band type thing every day. And then the evening concert at 8 o'clock. Plus, we've licensed almost the entire area and we're equipping it with free Wi-Fi. So we're hoping that people will just come down and want to sort of get a taste of the festival, and then they'll stay and they'll hang out, and ideally they'll become new audience members for the festival from here on in. So that's one approach that we're taking. In terms of the artistic programming, I mean, we're kind of always keep that in mind as well, that we're trying to reach as many people as possible. And I think you'll see that the programming, certainly on the main stage, is pretty varied and is greater or to a greater or lesser extent jazz, depending on your opinions. And that's done intentionally. We want to reach out to as many people as we can while still sort of maintaining the primary focus in the festival.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm assuming just like last night there was the sold out Willie Nelson show.
Right.
And I'm assuming that brought in a much wider audience than say some of the more niche jazz ensembles.
Yeah. And it's sort of an interesting struggle for me personally as artistically, because I look at a show like that and say, like, look, let's face it. I mean, that was not a jazz show last night. You know, I mean, it wasn't a jazz show. I will never argue that it was a jazz show. But it was a sold out house and it was a great show. I mean, it really was. Willie sounded fantastic. And the reaction of the audience was so exciting to see. I mean, these people in the audience were singing along to every song and were hooting and hollering. I mean, this was like a dream come true for some of these people to see Willie Nelson. So I sort of feel like if we can do a show like that and get people in and create some revenues for the festival that will allow us to present a Jason Moran and a Fred Kirsch and a Gregory Porter, then that's really great. The challenge there is trying to capture some of those people and say, thanks so much for coming to Willie Nelson. We're really glad you had a great time. We really want you to come back and check out Nathan Phillips Square and see what's going on there and see some of the other music that's happening at the festival. So that's a real challenge for us, is to actually capture some of those people. The other thing that we're doing is we are doing some educational programming and hoping that people will choose to engage with the music in a different way. So whether it's younger musicians that are seeking interesting performance opportunities or mentorship opportunities, or the other programs that we have. For example, we have a program for aspiring jazz journalists. We have a couple of sessions for teachers of jazz so that they can improve their skills. So we're trying to reach out to as many different parts of the community as we can and just invite them to engage more with the music. And we're hoping in turn that they will choose to engage more with the festival further down the line. They'll improve the experience of students further down the line and that sort of thing.
Cool. Where can people find info on all these programs? Because this was something that I'm very interested in is like, I mean, I love all the music related things, but also the more, you know, talking, like speaking kind of things, you know, like not strictly music. So the music journalist thing, like where can people go to sign up or?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you go to our website, which is www.torontojazz.com, you'll see along the menu there on the top, there's a section called education. So if you just click on that, you'll get sort of a breakdown of all the different programs that are run. And they're sort of annual programs right now. We run them every year during the festival, and we're having a lot of fun with them. We've got two great people that are part of the TDJ, the Toronto Downtown Jazz News Corps, this year. So again, these are aspiring jazz journalists that are, one is in a journalism program at Niagara College, and the other is actually doing a master's of film at York University, but has a very strong interest in writing about jazz. And so they submitted applications, and they get to work with a couple of seasoned jazz journalists in town, and it's hopefully going to be a good experience for everybody.
You were briefly mentioning like just the huge variety of shows, and I mean there's really like a ridiculous amount of music going on. We had another listener question, and it was related to some sort of festival pass. Mm-hmm. Are there any plans to have something like that maybe will make it more affordable for in the future?
Yeah, and it's something that we do look at frequently. We've had one in the past. We had Movado was the sponsor of a 3-pass and a 5-pass, which basically meant that if you were going to buy 3 concerts, we would give you a discount of a certain extent, and 5 concerts, a greater discount. I don't like that the conversation keeps coming back to money, but
yeah, sorry.
Ultimately, whenever you offer a discount to someone, it means that you're not making as much money. And we've relied on sponsors in the past to sort of underwrite that. So Movado, which was a fantastic sponsor for a number of years, basically we could go to Movado and say, look, we've sold all these passes. And so we've sold, let's say, I don't know what it would be. Let's say we've sold 100 tickets worth of passes. And we've given a discount on each of those tickets, which means that whereas we usually would have made X number of dollars on those hundreds of tickets, we've only made Y number of dollars. Can mm-hmm. you please cover the difference? And Movado would, and that was sort of their role in that as a sponsor there. Unfortunately, we don't have a sponsor for that program this year, and so we're not offering the passes this year. It's something that we do look at with some regularity, and there are some other festivals that, for whom it works very, very well. One of our close colleagues is John Nugent at the Rochester Jazz Festival, and he's figured out a system that basically, most of his shows every year are sold on a pass system, and he's able to sell them out because people are just so excited about getting the pass. And there's lots of things involved there. I mean, Rochester is a very different market, et cetera, et cetera. But the idea is really interesting to look at every year, and we're certainly thinking about how to make that happen.
Right. I could almost see, like, maybe even if some venues, like, this isn't you, obviously, but even if some venues could possibly do some kind of pass, like, I don't know. It's just a thought.
That's actually quite an interesting idea, like a venue-specific pass.
Yeah, and I mean, it is for sure, and every venue will sort of say the same thing. You know, you go to the Rex Hotel and say, well, I only want to pay $5 because I've got this pass. The Rex Hotel then has to go to the artist on stage and say, look.
Oh, man, yeah.
Sorry, but we only made this much cover because these people came with the pass.
Yeah.
And not to pick on the Rex Hotel, I mean, every venue is sort of the same. They need to maximize their revenue so that their artists are getting treated appropriately.
Yeah.
That said, there are hopefully ways to work in it. For example, in the contemporary music community, in which I also work, we launched something this past year called the New Music Passport. Basically, the passport was offered online. You go and you pay $25 to buy the passport, and that got you into 6 different shows over the course of the year for only $5.
Nice.
So what that meant was the person with the passport was getting a cheap ticket to every concert, but also because the passport cost $25, there was a pool of money at the end that gets distributed to all the organizations. Mm-hmm. It doesn't cover all the costs of the discounted tickets, but it's at least something. So I think there are ways to take a look at that and some creativity that people want to do.
Yeah.
You know, I actually never even thought, like when a person comes into a venue with a pass and they're paying less on a ticket, that it affects, you know, the if a musician's making their money off of the ticket sales, that it's affecting their pay. That sure. Never even occurred to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, like some venues are in a position where they've got larger budgets to work with. Maybe they have sponsors that are underwriting concert series. And so they can offer a guarantee to an artist. So then the guarantee is solid. And then the venue can sort of figure out if they want to attract more people by bringing in a discounted ticket price or something like that. Mm. But if a venue is strictly working on door and an artist is depending on those door proceeds, then unfortunately, yeah, any sort of discounted pass or, you know, guest list or something like that goes towards that pot of money that's ultimately going to go to the artist.
Right.
That, I just never put those two together.
No, I know. Same here. Wow. Yeah. So I kind of want to get more into the actual, like, the actual shows happening at the festival this year. Are there any shows that you personally would recommend? Maybe, like, under the radar shows happening? Or?
Sure. Well, I'm actually really excited about the whole series that we're doing at the Horseshoe. We're doing four shows there. These are some of the shows that I feel are kind of important jazz-wise. James Cotton is a legendary blues harmonica player. He's there on Sunday, June 23rd. Dr. Lonnie Smith is there on Monday, June 24th. And, you know, Lonnie Smith has been around for, I forget, I think it's 40 years now, 30, 40 years.
Jeez.
And so, like, he's a veteran on the scene, but he continues to make interesting music. And his side musicians, Jonathan Kreisberg on guitar, and Jamira Williams on drums. They're killer.
Right. I think he, Jamar Williams used to play, was he playing with Glasper for a while there, I think?
He's the regular guy for Christian Scott.
Right, okay.
Nice. I saw this group in New York in January and it was really fun.
Yeah.
Robert Glasper is there on Tuesday, June 25th. Of course, Robert's one of the most exciting players on the scene right now and just won the R&B Grammy last year.
Yeah.
And then Jason Moran's got this Fastballer dance party. And Jason has never been to Toronto under his own name, so I'm very, very excited that he's finally coming this year.
Nice.
So shows like that, I think those are going to be really, really great shows.
Yeah.
And then the two shows that we have down at the N-Wave Theater as well are going to be really great. Fred Hirsch is an incredible piano player, and he's doing a solo concert. That's on June 24th at 7 p.m. And Gregory Porter, who is generating just so much buzz and excitement right now in the jazz scene, great singer, is there on Thursday, June 27th. So I mean, those are six shows that are sort of not in huge venues that I think really warrant some attention.
Yeah.
Certainly when you have someone like a John McLaughlin, David Sambor, and Trombone Shorty, all those shows are going to be great on the main stage. And then on the main stage also we have this artist from Italy named Pino Danielli, who's coming in, who is huge, I mean, absolutely huge in Italy and less known here. So it's a really exciting opportunity to see someone that maybe we don't know as well.
That's great. Is there a difference you find? I mean, I imagine that you're the main guy when it comes to booking the artist. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, it's the decisions are made by committee. So I bring lots of ideas to the table, but my colleagues also do. And we sort of sit around and chew things over and figure out what's going to work best. But yeah, it's a committee decision.
Okay. Is there do you find there's a large difference in the process when it comes to booking like an international artist versus a more local act?
Yeah, I mean, an international artist almost inevitably comes with a larger fee. And so the thought process is a little more careful when it's an international artist. And at the same time with local artists, booking local artists is a bit of a tricky issue. And the reason it's tricky is because we have amazing musicians here in Toronto who play in Toronto all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they're playing at venues like The Rex and at Dominion on Queen and Gates 403 and Chalkers and things like that. And so there's lots of opportunity to see those musicians all throughout the year, which is fantastic and really vital for the scene. And it's just great that we have so many talented musicians. What that means, though, is when it comes time to the festival, for us to book a local artist the way we book artists, which is we book a venue, we book an artist, we pay them a fee, and we sell tickets, gets tricky. Because if you can go see person X at the Rex and pay $5 or $7 cover, or even pay what you can on a Saturday afternoon, why would you come to the jazz festival and pay $20 for a ticket?
Yeah.
So that's tricky for us, and it's frustrating that is so tricky, and it's frustrating that we're not able to
accommodate, right? Or
Not able to accommodate local musicians that way. That said, basically all the programming at the Shops at John Mills and the Distiller District and on the Big Band series at 12:30, basically all that programming is made up of local artists. So we still get to showcase them in a really exciting way. But there is definitely that difference there.
All right.
Now, Josh, just sort of for myself, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the Toronto Downtown Jazz Special Projects initiative.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. This is something that we've had for a couple of years, and it's I feel like it's a great way for us to be involved in the local community. So essentially what it is I created the program, I think, 3 years ago. We've done three rounds now. And it's a way for us to support local musicians throughout the year, beyond just the borders of the festival. And what we do is we invite applications from artists locally who are doing what we call special projects. So this is not just another show at a venue. This is something where an artist has written a bunch of new music that's getting premiered, or they're releasing a CD, or maybe they're bringing in a really special guest artist from out of town, or even from within town. They're doing some special collaboration that sort of goes beyond the scope of their regular activity. And successful applicants to the initiative get essentially Toronto Downtown Jazz acts as their publicist. So we'll write a press release, and we'll create a page on our website and promote it on the front page of our website. Plus, Jazz FM has been a great partner in this initiative the past couple of years, and they will promote it on air as much as they can. They'll do an on-air interview with each of the successful applicants. So it's just a way to help spread the word about some of the great projects that are happening in Toronto throughout the year.
Nice.
Great.
I'm pretty good for questions. This has been great. I've got a lot of info just about the Jazz Fest, like stuff I haven't known otherwise. Savik, do you have anything else, or?
Well, I mean, Josh, I know you're a performing musician yourself, so is there anything that you want to sort of promote for your own, of your own musical endeavors?
Absolutely. actually, we've got two really fun shows coming up, and one is during the festival. We're performing on Wednesday, June 26th, as part of the Big Band series. That's 12:30 on the main stage at Nathan Phillips, with my big band called the Toronto Jazz Orchestra. And this is going to be really fun for us because we're doing a celebration of Phil Nimmons. Phil, of course, is a legendary Canadian jazz musician and composer and just an incredible guy. He turned 90 this year on June 3rd.
Wow.
And so we're celebrating Phil Nimmons. We're going to do a bunch of Phil Nimmons repertoire, but also I've written a new suite and dedicated it to Phil, and we're going to give that its world premiere. So that's going to be a really fun show for us, June 26th. And then on June 30th at 7:30, we're going to be at the Rex Hotel doing the fourth edition of the Radiohead Jazz Project.
Oh yeah.
And this is something that we started a couple of years ago, I guess. I noticed that there's a school in the States that had done this recording called the Radiohead Jazz Project. I thought, well, this would be really fun. So every time we do this, we perform two sets of big band arrangements of Radiohead tunes, and then there's a local Radiohead tribute band called Idiotech, which is actually made up of all fantastic young jazz musicians. And so they'll play a long set. After we do our two big band sets, they do their set. And we've done it three times now, and every time it's been absolutely sold out, absolutely standing room only, and absolutely packed at the Rex. And it's just so much fun.
Nice.
So that's June 30th, starting at 7:30 at the Rex.
Cool. I'll be there.
Nice. Get there early.
yeah, for sure. Cool. Well, Josh, thank you so much, man. I'm personally really looking forward to the festival, and it should be a lot of fun, I think.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. It's great to have a chance to sort of chat about some of these things at length.
Cool. Maybe we'll try and do it again after the festival's done.
Sounds good.
Okay, take care.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Josh.
All right, so thanks again to Josh Grossman for coming on the show. We had a really good time with that awesome. With that discussion. Yeah, it was like learned a lot of things. And I mean, personally, I'm excited to see a lot of the shows and also to see Josh play. I've never seen him play before. So again, a reminder, Josh's two shows that he mentioned were, the Toronto Jazz Orchestra, playing at the Star Stage at Nathan Phillips Square, celebrating the music of Phil Nimmons. That's at 12:30 on June 26th and it's free.
Free shows.
Good thing. Don't need a pass for that. and then again, June 30th at the Rex, his Radiohead Jazz Project at 7:30, and get there early.
Yeah, that show is going to be really good. Lots of subdominant minor. It's going to be sick.
All right, cool. So that does it for an abbreviated version of episode 8. We'll catch up with you guys whenever the next show goes up, whenever that happens to be.
Yeah.
Right. Take care.
Thanks for tuning in.